This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, spellbinding songs, enchanting tunes, and the magic of music in fiction.
Now, we've touched on folk songs in the past, and I think we've sort of had a quick look at music, but not in very much depth.
No, we haven't. It's always been in passing so far.
Yeah, so we really wanted to kind of get this episode down, mainly because we're both quite big fans of music, and we've both used music in different ways in our books. However, rather than just looking at sort of songs itself, we did sort of want to look at music in a broader sort of spectrum.
Yeah, because in a way, music can be its own form of speculative fiction, just because it's not written down, just because there aren't necessarily even any words attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously still tells a story.
Yes, it does. Now, I think I'm probably going to start by talking about a book I read a very long time ago called The Wind Singer.
Yes, I did read that series.
You have read that one. Now, The Wind Singer, the concept of it, it was a very bizarre book.
Yep.
In a lot of ways. It was an incredibly bizarre book, but very interesting, very enjoyable. And music was used in a quite peculiar way in that book, in that you had this thing, this tower in the first book, which kind of gave off a sound, a sort of a song, and it had a piece missing, which when they put the piece in, it started making this sound, this beautiful song that kind of made everyone peaceful and sort of made everyone calm down a bit in this very sort of, not war-centric, but they were a very formulaic society.
It was quite totalitarian, wasn't
it? Totalitarian, yeah. It wasn't a very pleasant place, that's for sure. And toward the end, the sound was kind of used, and it was interesting because there were no lyrics attached to it at all. And obviously, from a reader's perspective, we could never hear the music. But the way it was described, the way that it affected the characters in the books, the general atmosphere was very, very interesting, because I'd never seen music used in this way before, where music itself was magic. Have you read it? The series? You have, yeah.
Yeah, I've read the series. I have to say I didn't really enjoy it that much, but that was in the days when if I didn't enjoy the first book, I still would try the second and third book,
mm-hmm.
which I don't do anymore, because living might be the longest thing any of us are ever going to do, but it's still too short a time to read books you don't like. So I personally didn't really like it, but I think in all fairness to the series, because I've heard a lot of people sing its praises, I read it right after I read His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, which I loved, and it compared so unfavourably to that in my mind, even though I wasn't deliberately linking them. I think that was part of the problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right about the music, and it is an interesting concept. I had seen something similar done in Madeleine L'Engle's A Swiftly Tilting Planet,
mm-hmm.
but it's much more of a music's this unconscious unifying force that sort of makes the universe in that.
Right. I haven't read that one, so I can't speak on.
It's good. Just spend a couple of hours on the back of a flying unicorn singing about the universe. It's great.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time.
Sort of psychedelic Christian fiction.
Jesus.
Yeah, literally.
I might have to give that a go then. Even though it sounds incredibly peculiar.
To be fair, I haven't given it the best description there.
So you weren't a particular fan of that series. I have to admit, I did read it when I was a lot younger, so I don't know how it would hold up now that I'm older.
Yeah, when did I read it? I was sort of 1920. So it was quite a long time ago, admittedly. And
yeah.
You would have probably actually been a child, so you'd have been the right age group for it.
Yeah.
Which I wasn't.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. I don't know how it would hold up if I read it now, but it was definitely the first time that I'd seen music done in that way. And in that sense, it was very, very interesting. So, yes, there's that.
That is one of the really interesting things about music in fiction, in written fiction, is the fact that you as the reader are not audibly hearing anything unless they're mentioning a song that you're familiar with or a piece of music you're familiar with, which might add an extra dimension to it. But they could be talking about anything, and something that sounds magical, like fairy music or whatever.
Yeah.
Mentioned in an awful lot of books with fairies in them. And it does add this auditory dimension, even though you're not literally hearing something. Music's
yeah.
very, very good at setting mood and tone and also theme.
Mm-hmm.
So without necessarily whacking your reader in the face with it, using a piece of music and how you describe the music itself, because obviously you're not playing it, can reinforce ideas of theme and obviously tone and mood, as we've said.
Yeah. No, I'm completely with you. There are also, of course, cases, and we'll talk about films and stuff like that, where we do actually hear the music itself. And actually, in some ways, that's more difficult, because if you've described music in a book, and you've described how enchanting it is and how it sort of lifts you up and sort of cradles you to sleep, the film directors have got a real hard time creating a piece of music which is going to have a similar kind of effect on their audience.
Yeah.
Now, for instance, a good example is the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, where you have Mr. Tumnus sends Lucy to sleep.
Yeah.
In order to alert the witch.
Yes.
Now, that does happen in the books. I didn't just imagine that, did I?
No, that does happen. Everyone forgets that Mr. Tumnus starts off as a traitor.
Yeah. Well, I never forgot that he started off as a traitor. Thank you very much. he had a redemption arc. That was the point.
That sounds right. Okay, I know that is actually true, but Mr. Tumnus redemption arc just sounds wrong together.
But yeah, so God, you've got me started now.
Sorry.
But yeah, the I found actually that they say what you want about those films. I thought they were actually quite good. And I thought that the way they did the music there was very well done. And often the way they do it is through adding other instruments and effects to show that there is a bigger kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes when we're listening to music, especially if it's just one instrument, sometimes if you close your eyes, you kind of brought up in this whirlwind of kind of feelings, and it just, the music feels bigger than it actually is on the one instrument.
Yeah.
And the way they can mimic that is to actually physically make it bigger, in that you add other instruments, you add theme beneath it, especially if you've had a theme throughout which has elicited certain responses. So there's a little theme which goes with a character, or there's a little theme that goes with a sort of situation. So immediately, the moment you hear that theme, that emotion is conjured. For instance, another good example is the Star Trek theme.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that always stirs feelings in us, doesn't it?
Star Wars as well.
Star Wars, yeah, exactly. Star Wars is particularly good because they each have very individual themes, and when you hear it, it elicits a response, and it makes you think about it, even if it's just subconscious, even if you don't realise that, oh wait, every time that piece comes on, he's in the scene, or she's in the scene, or usually it's when someone's about to die, things like that.
Yes. it's like, you've obviously played Skyrim. And you get that bit of music when enemies are about and you can't see them yet. But Alan always calls it the something bad is happening theme, as in something bad is happening and it's happening to you right now.
Well, I remember I was sitting working one day and I suddenly had this terrible dread filling me about, oh gosh, something awful is about to happen, or like, you know, excitement when you're anxious about something, waiting for something bad to happen. And I couldn't figure out why it was. And then I realized that I had all the windows open and the person in the flat below me was watching Game of Thrones. And I could hear the theme music and I was like, oh, that's why I'm feeling readily anxious.
Yeah, that just goes to show how powerful it is.
Exactly. So when you kind of add those extra little themes beneath a single song, you can elicit a huge response. But I think it's very, very difficult to do. And I think quite often, especially in films, music is, we're walking away from those big kind of themes and going towards just filler sounds in the background.
Yeah.
So you don't have tunes that... Yeah, you don't have tunes that follow. I mean, for instance, I saw this great thing, which was that they went around asking people to sing theme tunes from Marvel, from superhero films.
Yeah.
And no one could do any except for the Spider-Man one.
Which technically wasn't really from the film. It was originally from the old cartoon, wasn't it?
It was, but of course they did put it in the film this time.
Yeah.
Which was probably a good move, because I think it's so iconic that they would have lost it. But yeah, no one else could really think of any one piece of music from any of the other films, except of course Iron Man, of course, when you have AC/DC. But yeah, there was nothing iconic about it, and I think that something's lost in that sense.
Yeah, it is. And to not to labour the point, but the AC/DC theme, that song was originally from the cartoon. Again, so they've obviously really given these cartoons that were made from the original graphic novels these great theme songs, and then when they went to make the more adult films and things from it. You're right, they're missing a trick. A lot of it is just to... The music is there just to sort of link everything together. Because I reckon if you took the music out, you'd just have a series of crashes and bangs and fight scenes and...
Yeah.
You'd probably find that it doesn't link together very well.
No. And it also, it's just, but the music is literally just there in the background. It doesn't really elicit that much of an emotional response from you.
No, it doesn't. It is, in a way, that's where it's done. It's obviously all done quite manipulatively anyway, whenever you put music or, you know, fiction itself is quite manipulative. But it's still at the scaffolding stage with the Marvel films, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. They're really, after that many films, they could probably have...
hire a musician, guys.
Time on it. We're being unfair on obviously the musicians who we use, and I think probably the real problem is to do with place tracks. I've forgotten what they're called, but it's what happens is directors pick other pieces of music from other films and they put them in certain scenes and then say, right, do something like this. So musicians aren't really given a chance to have those...
No, what they're asking for is basically auditory furniture.
Exactly. Auditory furniture, and they've already handed them the design saying, this is exactly what we want, just muffle it around a little bit so that it's a bit different. And you're like, that's really constraining for a creative person.
It's almost a real insult, isn't it?
Yeah, and then I think, did you ever, we must have talked about it before, but we have, I know, BBC Robin Hood.
Yes.
Now that theme, da 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 da.
No, I never paid attention to that. I was really only in it for Richard Armitage.
No, but like
Guy Liner, I was totally in it for that.
Yeah, but I mean, it was the opening theme as they came in, and it was the rush of, because it sounds so like they've drawn on so many things. In that sense, it's drawn a lot of influence on other things, but you hear it and you're immediately like, yeah, that's, you know, swashbuckling, because, you know, that's a different thing, but, you know, sort of the whole archery thing, you can really feel it. And that song actually came up in my in my music exam. And I was like, this is the most epic thing.
Not to deviate this into Robin Hood, but
no.
going back to what we were saying about Errol Flynn, Robin Hood, and you know, Robin Hood, riding through the Glen, that one.
Yeah.
Oh, my dad actually gave me a whole batch of Errol Flynn DVDs for my birthday. So I've been watching them, and actually all of them, not just Robin Hood, they've all got these really quite epic theme tunes that, you know, sort of really encapsulate the films. I mean, looking at the films now, it's like, yeah, I've got a lot of affection for this, but my God, if it had been me fighting him to get across the river, I'd have killed him by now about five times over, because the fighting is that bad. But anyway, I digress. But yeah, it is interesting when you think that things like, well, you have these iconic characters like Robin Hood, they seem to have really splashed out and got decent themes. Historically, this goes all the way back as well.
But it's something else which I'm noticing, which is that we're getting more of that kind of that music in TV series now.
Yes.
Rather than in films. It's like they don't really have time to do it in films, which is a bit of a shame, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not where the budget goes. I mean, going back, I don't want to go on to Twilight too much, but I will mention the films because whatever you think of the stories and the books and the films themselves, the music's fantastic.
Mm.
The music is really, really good. It's by Carter Burwell in the first and last films, and the two in the middle are done by Howard Shore. And okay, part of this is my weakness for classical piano, but the music is absolutely beautiful, and it really, really fits. It's so underused in the films, in my opinion, but if you actually listen to the score, it's fabulous.
Right, it's not a bad score. I'll give you that. And yeah, again, there are themes that go throughout it. And but anyway, we're talking about themes in music, and what we should really be talking about is music is in sort of the magical kind of elements of it and the magical qualities of it. So we digressed a bit.
You threw me off with your Mr. Tumnus redemption arc.
I'm very, very sorry. Please accept my most humble apology. Anyway, where were we? Don't say Mr. Tumnus.
I didn't need to. No, we were looking at music as this magical, creative type thing.
Yes. Now, I think going back even further, I think someone who really encapsulated adding music into stories was and sort of having songs within particularly epic fantasy and sort of high fantasy was Tolkien.
Yes, probably.
Well, I just feel that you can't go a single... you can't read any one of his books without finding a song in it.
No, you're right. And to be fair, sometimes that really works and sometimes it doesn't. And I think it's just a personal thing on whether it works for me or not.
Yeah.
And I am utterly the pot calling the kettle black here, because every time every one of the unveiled books has got more music in it. So, I can go along. So I'm aware that I'm on very thin ice here, but. Certainly, I didn't think The Hobbit needed quite as much as it had, for example, but it worked okay in Lord of the Rings because it was this constant sort of themic presence in the background.
Yeah.
Probably because it was a larger, well, it was a set of three books, it was a larger scope thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I tend to agree with you.
And the Silmarillion is just nuts, so who knows what's going on there, let's be honest.
No one knows what was happening. No, that's fair. But yeah, there's an entire bit in Lord of the Rings where, you know, the council, they're all there and they're trying to do stuff. And Bilbo just breaks into song.
Yes. And because that's what hobbits do.
That's what hobbits do. Everyone's like, are you done?
Which made Lord of the Rings the musical quite interesting, if you think about it, because you've got dwarves and elves and evil wizards and Nazgul also.
I'd love to hear Nazgul.
I think it was more sort of hissy chant thing going on. You can't really work out the words. I think it's in the language of Mordor as well.
Oh,
which
of course.
Is, you know, just awesome.
Excellent. Right. Sorry, no, I'm just imagining Nazgul. I'm just imagining Nazgul singing. Mordor, Mordor. Do they have dental? Clearly not. Anyway, but that was an example of sort of music used to encapsulate a kind of a mysticism within the world.
Yeah.
And I felt that it was actually used quite successfully in that respect.
Yeah, definitely. I think as I promote the underlying themes of the books in certainly Lord of the Rings, it does in The Hobbit as well. It's just that I didn't think we needed quite as much of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's Tolkien and you can't tell Tolkien what to do.
Tolkien makes his own rules.
Tolkien made the rules for the genre. So it's kind of like, you can bite me.
Tolkien is the epitome of I do what I want.
Yeah, in fairness to Tolkien, there wasn't very much actual high fantasy before that, so, you know, maybe he does get a pass on that one.
Yeah, but I do really feel that in the case of Tolkien, it was... he could get away with it, because actually a lot of the tales that he was telling would previously have been sort of bard tales.
Yeah.
They would have been sung. And in that respect, adding music to it almost makes sense.
Well, it does in that respect, definitely, because you're connecting it to a long history of tradition as well. Yeah. And I suppose that's worth a little side mention, in that a lot of folklore and folk tales and things were actually, you know, if you go back into the mists of time, were actually sung, because it was a lot easier to remember things for people who didn't write things down.
Mm-hmm.
If you set it to music.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I can listen to a song twice and have it pretty much word perfect.
Yeah, no, me too.
But yeah, you know, setting it to music or making it rhyme makes it easier to remember.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. But it also adds this another element to it, I feel, because it really, we've mentioned this before, how music brings emotion, and how music isn't just about the sort of the memory, it stirs other things.
Yes.
Within you. And by adding the music, I feel as if, oh god, I can't find my words here. I'm not having a good day. I feel as if it's brought to life in another way.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I mean?
I think so, yeah. I think music does add another dimension to it.
Yeah. And I think that by adding the music, by adding songs into The Lord of the Rings and the other books and things along those lines, it stirs up our kind of ancient memories of those times and those tales and that life. So even without having heard the music, we kind of get an echo of it.
Yeah, I can see what you mean.
You don't sound convinced.
I'm mulling it over. Well, you know, you have just sort of postulated we have some sort of race memory for music, which, you know, no. Might possibly be true.
It's not so much that, but it's in like, we don't have a race, necessarily have a race memory for music, but we do kind of have a, we've all watched enough films, we've all watched enough things to be able to associate stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it taps into another part of your brain, definitely.
Yeah.
Except, I mean, there are those rare people who just don't really listen to music, and I've never understood that.
When I was, sorry, this is a real side note. When I was working with Foundation Music to try and get people to come and join us, that sounds really cultish, at the university to come and try out music. I would work the stand some days and sort of try and convince pupils to come and talk to me. And often they did not want to talk to me, which I didn't understand because I was very welcoming. And I would shout, come over, if you like music, come and talk to me. And they would go, I don't like music. And I... And I just look them dead in the eye. I say, yes, you do. Stop lying. Come and talk to me. And they would always look so affronted, like, oh, you're right. I do like music. I was lying. And it was literally because I would go through these questions of, did you listen to music when you got up this morning? Yes. Did you listen to music on the car on the way here? Yes. One guy said, I don't like music. And he was listening to his iPod at the time. I was like, what are you listening to? White noise? Clearly you like music. Come over here and talk to me. But yeah, avoiding music is almost impossible in this day and age. It is literally everywhere. You cannot get away from it.
No, you can't. I can't see why you... Well, I mean, it depends. There's always bits of music you don't like. I'm not a big fan of the really experimental jazz.
Yeah, that's fine.
Makes me vaguely homicidal.
I'm not a big fan of experimental jazz either. But you can't escape it. Even if you don't put music on, it is literally everywhere. It is in the shops. It is in your car. It is on your phone.
It's constantly playing in my head. If you were in my head, you'd be hearing music.
Just elevator music.
Well, sometimes it's elevator music, and you know, sometimes it's what was it recently? It was Rolling Stones' Ruby Tuesday. That was in there for a good 3 days. So you know, it depends. It's not just getting something stuck in my head, but I don't think inside my head is ever actually quiet.
No.
This is making me sound a bit nuts. So let's deviate this back away towards music and pretend I didn't say any of this.
No, I'm completely with you. I've almost always got music going on in my head. At the moment, I've got memory going on in my head, which is weird because I don't actually know the song memory, the lyrics or anything. So I've literally just got the first line. Da, 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 and it's just looping.
That's going to be in my head now. And I do actually know all the words to that.
Yeah, but that's the thing, is the way to get rid of a song that's an earworm. is to think of the ending, is to let it finish.
Yeah.
Because more often than not, it only loops in your head because you keep going back to a sort of a central part. Because I only know the beginning, I can't make it end.
Yes, okay. But no, you're right, it is true. And this is why I ended up learning so many folk songs. So I was trying to research it for something and I just kept getting bits stuck in my head. So I then ended up learning, I think, 8 new folk songs. So that was fun.
The problem is when you have songs that go into fade and that's how they end, because there's no ending. Fade.
Well, sometimes you can dislodge an earworm by putting a different worm in there, but you've got to be careful with that.
Yeah. You're just replacing one demon with another.
Getting back to music as theme, yes. I'll go back to the Phil Rickman, Merrily Watkins mystery novels, mm-hmm. which are, you know, crime, and also they're a little bit of a look at, I suppose, Christian religion, Christian mysticism, and below that, sort of the pre-Christian Celtic pagan roots. And there's one character who's mostly a side character in these books, and he sort of becomes the love interest, if you like. Really mm-hmm. nice guy called Lawrence Robinson, known as LOL. It makes sense when you read the books. Anyway, uh-huh. he's a folk musician, heavily influenced by Nick Drake. And you get little snatches of his songs in the books. And his songs really encapsulate the underlying emotional theme, which is much quieter than the main theme of the book. And it sort of helps hold it all together in the same way that, you know, the bass guitarist helps hold, you know, a band together
mm-hmm.
As the bridge between sort of the drums and the lead guitar, etc. He sort of does that with just his little bits of theme, his little character observations and things. He's one of the most observant characters in the books. And he just gets comparatively small amounts of time. Anyway, the latest in this series, it's book 14 in the series. So I've been
going on.
it's really funny, actually. I started reading these books when I was 17, and the daughter of Mary Watkins, the vicar in it, was, I think, 15 when the book started, and now she's 19. And obviously I'm still reading the books, and it's some time later. It's like, yeah, you've aged like 4 years in the last 20, kind of thing. But anyway, going back to this, it's really good. The last one that I just read, this character, Lowell Robinson, got a little bit more of a part in it because it was looking at the dark side of Morris dancing, which sounds ridiculous until you actually read it, and then it's super creepy. Really, really super creepy. So he was writing stuff all around the turning of the year and the winter solstice and the idea of dancing the dark Morris to bring the sun back, as it were. And he gets roped into taking the part of the Green Man in this Morris dancing ritual, which, you know, had already gone wrong once because two people have died. So it was all pretty dark. But it held the whole thing together really well. And in some ways, he sort of held the entire series together because his little bits of folk music and his observations that he makes through the songs he writes sort of holds the underlying, you know, it's, I don't know if this is right, the basso continuo. It's the one line that the rest of the book sort of embellish around. So it's done very, very cleverly. I don't know if Phil Rickman set out to do that with this character in the first place, where he just noticed it happening and thought, yeah, I'm gonna leave that there, kind of thing. But either way, round of applause.
I really, every time we speak, you give me more to read. And if there's 40 books in this series, I'm going to be really busy for the next century.
Sorry, that is the occupational hazard of being friends with me. I'll give you a reading list.
Oh, dearie me. I'm reading The Witches of Whitby. The Whitby Witches, rather. Because of you. Anyway, that's not to do with this episode. Though I do feel like we should do an episode just about witches.
Yeah, totally. We haven't done that yet. So, future episode.
Kestrel can...
That would go well. In all fairness, Emlyn's not got a lot of good to say about witches either, so...
No, she does not. Now, speaking of Emlyn... You say Emlyn and I say Emmeline. I'm clearly a Kieran man.
Yeah. Kieran says Emmeline too, so there you go.
Yeah. Speaking of Emmeline and Unveiled, you've obviously used music quite a lot as well. And not just in... Because we've spoken in the past about how you've used folk songs to accentuate legends and myth and lore within the books, but in the last couple especially, by which I mean the second and the third, obviously I haven't had the privilege of reading the fourth yet, you just keep torturing me with it.
Yep.
You've actually used music in a slightly different way. It wasn't just song lyrics, so song lyrics come up more in the second one. So talk to me a little bit about that, because the second book is obviously set at a music camp.
Yes. I suppose, again, I was sort of using music to convey theme, and there were connections. I mean, one verse from a song is worth like about 3 or 4 chapters expounding on a subject, I found, depending on what you're trying to get across. And obviously I mentioned Black Eyed Dog by Nick Drake, which is a song that most people attribute to him in his really, really depressed phase. I mean, you've obviously heard the Black Dog of Depression is something Winston Churchill said as well. But Black Eyed Dog is this like quite haunting and slightly creepy little melody that sort of weaves in and out of itself, and it's very low key, and it's only when you really listen to it, it's like this creature just hounding this person until they finally give up. And Nick Drake may have deliberately or may have accidentally killed himself with a drug overdose.
Yeah.
When he was 26. He certainly suffered from depression and anxiety, and there wasn't the same level of help at the time. And the really sad thing about it was he was this incredibly talented musician and didn't get any real recognition until after he died.
Yeah.
So it was almost like the best thing he could do for his music was to take himself away from it. And this is coming at a difficult point for in the series, because, you know, she sort of embraced the idea that she's got this ability she never wanted, but at the same time she's recognizing that it's not just a good thing. There's a bad side to it too, and she's trying to balance the idea of the two. So really, I was sort of getting all that in, and I was cheating by mentioning this Nick Drake song rather than really describing it all. And I think it sort of comes through okay. It certainly get the black-eyed dog gets mentioned very briefly again in book three when she's talking to another character, because it's shorthand for saying, okay, this dark side of my personality, I'm really frightened it's taking over, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's mentioned once again there. And then I've got other pieces of music that I picked either because I just really like them, or usually I've picked them because I really like them, but usually I've picked them because they're something that...
There's an underlying...
It makes sense. The only thing that I didn't actually expound on was when you have them, the four of them playing in a quartet at the final concert, and I didn't say what they were playing.
Do you know what they were playing?
I've got ideas, and other people have suggested other ideas, which they think it should be. And because they've suggested things as well, and in their heads it's become that's part of their headcanon, I'm like, I'm not ever going to say what I think it is because I don't want to ruin it.
Yeah, just let people have this.
Anyway, in book three, I've gone down the sort of indie folk rock type route a bit.
Pies and all the fingers.
I don't know if that's even really a thing, but I discovered recently, obviously, you know, Simon and Garfunkel and The Sound of Silence, presumably. Mm-hmm. I quite liked this metal band called Disturbed, and I found that they covered The Sound of Silence.
Oh,
and
right.
It sounds completely different, but it's utterly fantastic. And it captures the same thing that Simon and Garfunkel did, and it's given it a slight twist. And it's like, I love seeing that done. That's really, really well done. Obviously, I haven't used this myself, but it just kind of got me thinking that I don't see why you couldn't take a traditional sea shanty and do something similar with it, which is kind of like what one of the characters has done.
Yes, he has.
Yes, he has. Everything he writes is creepy.
I wonder why.
But actually, music itself, music and song particularly, are actually important and powerful in their own right in book three. And literally powerful kind of thing.
Yeah.
So again, it's always echoing underlying themes and descriptions that I don't necessarily want to have to go and describe myself. So it's just about creating chains of association.
Yeah. I also want to talk very, very quickly about Lucas.
Yes. That's unusual for you.
I know. For some reason, I've forgiven him a little bit more now that I've remembered he's French. Isn't that crazy? I'm a little bit more willing to sort of let him off the hook. I'm a terrible person.
It's like, I hate you. I want you to stay away from Emlyn. She's not for you.
Oh, you're French. No, I still maintain that they shouldn't be together, but I like him more than now that I know he's French, which sounds crazy, but hey-ho, it's the truth. Now, there's obviously, without wanting to give too many spoilers away, there's obviously a kind of a mystical thing going on with Lucas. And his relationship with Emmeline, I feel, is actually accentuated by having the music. Which is very interesting, because again, these are books. We're not hearing the music. And yet, the association of music... And every time that from then on, pretty much, that kind of any form of classical music is mentioned, it's like having those themes. Lucas comes to mind because he's so entwined with it. And previously, music was something which was very much to do with Emmeline's mother.
Yes.
Because it was Emmeline's mother's violin, and then, you know, all sorts of other things. And somehow, not to say that Lucas has shoved the memory of Emmeline's mother out of the, you know, window, but he becomes very much associated with that classical music completely. And in the same way, Kieran has been totally, is the total opposite end of that spectrum. He's not musical at all. He's tone deaf, isn't he?
Yeah, obviously that's something you don't really find out to book three, but it's no big spoiler to say no. there's a quite amusing scene, or at least I found it amusing when I was writing it. Where I won't say word for word in case people want to read it for themselves, but yeah, basically he just he likes music. He's a little bit in awe of it and loves listening to it, and definitely he's got things that he really enjoys and that sort of things that you find out in book four. But his aptitude for creating any sort of music, his aptitude for anything other than whistling is like zero. He can just about keep a tune if he's whistling, otherwise he's just utter rubbish, cannot do it at all.
I feel sorry for him. Especially because, yeah, he is in awe of music. And obviously, having someone who is so musical, and we mentioned this in the previous episode about, you know, wanting a guy in a band.
Yes, girls like musicians.
Yeah, which is funny because literally that's what happens with Grace.
Yeah, that was really funny. I didn't see that coming. Anyway.
And then obviously it happens with Emmeline to a certain degree, because she falls in love a little bit with Lucas, even if that love is a kind of it's a very different sort of love. But again, that the music adds a depth to it, and it adds a culture to it as well. And this is again without even hearing it, I really really like that relationship in that sense between the two of them and the music. I feel like that's the entirety of their relationship is sort of connected to the music, and only really to the music. And it's almost ethereal in that sense, because it's not actually connected on an earthly level. It's through something theoretical and emotional and quite technical.
Yeah, and there's definitely a literal spiritual element to it as well. It is music and death kind of thing. And it's not necessarily unhealthy, but it's also not really, it's not of life. It's not it's not something that grounds you in life, as it were. And obviously, Em has started to have difficulties with, you know, life as it is. So,
yeah.
Which, I won't go into that.
But... which isn't great, yeah.
just no spoiler for book four, but the one piece I have used in book four is Schubert's Death and the Maiden, or Der Tod und das Mädchen.
Ah,
so that was lots of fun, and I do really like that as a piece of music as well, but there is something inherently very disturbing about it if you listen to it as well. Something that M describes as, you know, part of it sounds to her like a fatal dance.
Yeah.
And actually uses the words fatal dance, and it's like, yeah, it's that's pretty much where it is. And it, again, it's enhancing the overall theme of the book, not just the theme of her friendship with another character. But everyone can see through that, but you know.
Yeah.
She's not going to announce it.
Friendship.
Yeah. No, not the friendship bit, who the character is. Goodness. What are you suggesting, that she changes her mind?
Don't do this to me.
I have to.
I think an example of when I've used music in writing, and for me, I am, you know, I'm quite musically minded. I have my little choir, and I was a music scholar at my university, and I play lots and sing, and I say dance. I don't dance. I'm terrible at dancing, so but I do love music, and I've used it only intermittently within the Hermartius cycle. And in particular, I think there's one scene where the music creates an active, energetic environment, and that's the violin duel.
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah. Where a lot of people have reported how happy that scene makes them feel, how kind of energetic, and it was about writing the music without actually having the sort of the sound, but being able to create the atmosphere of it.
Yeah, definitely. Small side confession, I've sort of stolen that a little bit and twisted it.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
It's not a happy scene though, so don't worry.
That doesn't make me feel better. I think we're going to have to end soon, but there is one last film I want to talk about where music in particular is done quite well, and that is Song of the Sea.
I still haven't seen. I must watch that at some point.
You really do have to watch that. And the concept of the Song of the Sea is that the Selkie's song will save everyone. You've got a bunch of people who've been turned to stone, and if the Selkie sings, everyone will be saved. And so there's this song, which is repeated throughout, and it's called The Song of the Sea, and I love it. I've done several versions of it, and I love it to bits. And it's not the only song. There's several songs which are sung, which are the old traditional ones. But again, it's magic which is tied with music. And if we look at music on the whole, we look at its place within society. The first place you really kind of used to get music was a lot to do with worship.
Yeah.
And I think that when I was little, I used to say that music is literally the song of the god, is the language of the gods. Because it adds another dimension to it, and it's just so beautiful that I can't imagine sort of divine beings speaking just like we do, you know?
Yeah, and to be honest, I think it depends. If you have parents who sing to you from a very, very young age, you might start singing and experimenting with music. Experimenting music makes it sound like drugs, doesn't it? But, you know, you might...
Are you experimenting with music?
Or art? But you might start doing it very, very young. Otherwise, it depends on what sort of school you go to, because obviously they try and bring music in on a curriculum because it's creative and everything. But if you get sent to a religious-centric school, which I was sent to Catholic schools, both the Catholic primary school and obviously the convent after that.
Yeah,
you couldn't escape it. There was music every day, and all of it was part of the whole sort of religious worship type thing. So, I mean, I was in the school choir all the way up through school, from being very, very small all the way up to being a teenager. And then outside of school, I ended up, basically because it was like a socialising thing with my mum, going to choir outside of it, and then socialised with my dad, who wasn't actually anything to do with the church at that point in time, but somehow, funny side story, but I won't go into it, but had discovered he could actually sing after 20 years of denying that he could. and had started performing in musicals and things. I ended up going along with my dad to things like that. So there's something very harmonising. No pun intended. There's something about socialising.
Don't you say that to me. No pun intended, my ass.
There's something that links people together. Music can link people in a way that perhaps words can't, because words can't fully encompass things in the same way.
Yeah,
but there's a shortcut through music, I think, is what I'm trying to get at with my clumsy words.
No, I completely agree with you, and I think, yeah, that your point is indeed made. I agree with you. Well, I think we've run out of time.
We have. We'll have to revisit music again at some point.
Yes, I think so too. Hit us up with any of your favourite pieces of music, or books, or literature. Books and literature are the same thing.
Not necessarily.
Thank you. Books, literature, films, anything like that, where you have found the music has worked or hasn't worked, or where you wish there had been more music or less. Let us know in the comments, and thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.